On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Elizabeth Edwards has always been the wife, not the candidate, but she knows how to make news. When her husband, John Edwards, was on the White House ticket in 2004, she was not shy about saying Lynn Cheney should settle down about public discussion of the Cheney's daughter's homosexuality. Just last month, she apologized for headlines that had her saying her life choices, home and children, had made her happier than in the fray Senator Hillary Clinton. But it hasn't all been roses. Elizabeth Edwards has dealt with the sudden death of a teenage son, a breast cancer diagnosis on the day of her husband's 2004 defeat. Up next on Point, a conversation with Elizabeth Edwards about life and loss and politics. Joining me now in the studio is Elizabeth Edwards, wife, lawyer, mother of four. Her new memoir is Saving Graces, Finding Solace and Strength from Friends and Strangers. Elizabeth Edwards, thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
There's so much we want to hear from you, and you're putting a lot out there for the public, and some of it's wonderful, and some of it's not easy at all. You really reach out to people who have taken hits as well. I wonder if you'd, though, take us in with a little reading from the book that takes us back to the beginning of your courtship with John Edwards, or his courtship of you. Could you just plunge in and give us that night, the first date of Elizabeth and John?
A little inauspicious, I have to say. John picked me up in his red duster. It was a flood car. He and his dad had cleaned out the mud, and the black and white checkered interior gleamed. He wore a bow tie, I've never seen him in one since, and a sweater vest, also not a staple of his current wardrobe. And he took me to the Holiday Inn to dance to a disc jockey under a disco ball. I could hardly hear a word he said for hours. As he drove me home, I decided that Glenn, who'd set us up, would hear from me what a waste of time this was. And then, at my door, John leaned over and kissed me on the forehead, said goodnight, and walked to his car. In an era of fast-forward sexual relationships, I was used to the fight at the door, or worse, in my apartment. And then this sweet and tender gesture. I suppose if he hadn't turned out to be the sweet and tender man that gesture promised, I might not be writing of this at all. But he was, and is. And so, when years later I talked to our son Wade about his first kiss, I told him not to underestimate the power of a gentle kiss. It had won me over that first date. I never went out with anyone else again.
Elizabeth Edwards, reading from her new memoir, Saving Graces. So you were quite a beauty, and a kiss on the forehead sealed the deal right there. There's some advice.
It did. The fast forward, I think, didn't matter what you looked like, particularly. So I don't know that... That the description of me is right, but the description of that night is exactly what happened.
That was how many years ago?
That was January of 1975.
And here you are all these years later, a lot of roads traveled, some great times and some very difficult times. And now as the wife of a lawyer turned politician, senator, and then vice presidential candidate, and maybe presidential candidate again, you're putting your life out in a very public way by choice this time, and I wonder why, after all the intrusions on that public life by your husband's public life.
Well, we haven't ever been very private people. Honestly, if you think you're going to go into politics, it's best not to try to pretend you're going to have some privacy. Mm-hmm. But we had given that up a long time ago. We had the kind of open house that people walked in our door and yelled that they were standing in our kitchen. There are lots of boys in their 20s who have seen me in flannel pajamas over a large number of years.
Right.
If I wanted something private, I had to leave a note, do not come in this cabinet. This is for family members only, because honestly, everything about our lives was open. And it was important to be honest about this, so I needed to be open about the things I talked about in here if I wanted the book to do any good, and I hope it does.
So let's jump in and get personal right away. Update us on your family, then. What's up with your kids, and what's up with John as we speak today?
John is the easy one. He's actually has a book coming out tomorrow, a collection of essays by famous people and people who aren't famous about the homes they grew up in and the influence that had on their lives. After he finishes his book tour, he will probably make a decision. He says he's very seriously considering another run at the Democratic nomination.
He's been all over the country. I've heard people saying Edwards is out there. He's working it. That looks like he's quite likely to say he's going for it.
Yeah, now he... honestly, if you're thinking about going for it, you need to be out there. But he was also, and he wasn't just in primary states prior to this election last week. That he has been all over the place, fighting on minimum wage initiatives in a number of states. I don't know, five or six states, and they, you know, every one of them won overwhelmingly. I'm not going to credit him, but at least I believe he was on the right side of that issue.
So, husband John, very much on the trail, not declared for 08 yet. And right. What about the kids?
Our oldest daughter, Kate, who's 24, is a first-year law student at Harvard Law School, mm-hmm. and I think she's. And she says it's challenging, and she loves it. So that's exactly what I'd hoped for.
And the latecomers you had when you were 48 and 50?
Yes, I now have an 8-year-old in third grade and a 6-year-old, Jack, who did not want me to go back out on the book tour, said he was going to give me a 15-yard penalty for leaving. Apparently, he's been watching a little bit too much of football.
but that makes you definitely a 50-plus mom of quite young kids. How's that going?
Well, I mean, it's tiring. I have a lot more patience than I had for my first set, but it's a lot less energy. And so I get tired more easily, and I'm sure that recovering from the cancer treatment adds to that.
You start the book, Saving Grace, is your memoir, with yourself in the shower in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and oops, there's something in the breast. It feels like a lump. You go on to describe how on the day of the concession speeches, 04, you were out getting a formal diagnosis of breast cancer. How's your health today, Elizabeth?
Thank you for asking. I seem to be cancer-free. So, you know, knock on wood, that continues. I've got absolutely fabulous treatment here in Boston and in Washington, and now my continuing care in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where we live.
And behind all of this, we'll look at that as well. I mean, that was someday. But behind all of this, you've got a kind of message here about hanging in there in many ways, about leaning on people, friends and strangers who supported you, and about coming through tragedy, the kind of... sudden tragedy in your case of your son, teenage son's death, Wade. But an awful lot of American families are taking the deaths of young men and women now out of Iraq. You know, we don't see those bodies. They come back to Dover, not on camera, but they come back quite steadily. I wonder if that is ever on your mind. Your son was 16. No small number of these casualties are in their teens.
There are a large number of them. I when I watch the names at the end of news programs, it breaks my heart as you read the ages of these children. And my dad was in the Navy. I grew up. He was in Vietnam, and I remember the way we honored the returning dead. Even in the times in the anti-war times, the returning dead were treated with a dignity, and it breaks my heart that we're not doing the same thing now for these men and women who have made such sacrifice and for their families. I think about them all the time. I thought about him during the campaign as I met their parents along the way. And the book was written partly because a lot of those people came up to me and said they couldn't be out campaigning or doing something as very public, that they had been too decimated by the loss. And I thought, I was decimated by my loss too, and I think I described how decimated I was by it. But I found strength because I grabbed hold of the people around me. It's like if you have people all in a circle around you, it's hard to fall down. And that's how I was all the time, with people, you know, at my side. I pulled them closer to me. I'd been pulling them my whole life, but I pulled them even closer in times of need.
We'll look at that story. But I wonder how you see politics. You came across Elizabeth Edwards as such a kind of real person on the trail, not putting on the dog, just right out there. Sometimes your candor made headlines, people saying, hey, well, she can't say that.
Yeah.
But what about that whole realm? Everyone's been thinking about politics in the last few weeks, coming to the midterms and now looking at the presidential race in front of us. Can you be in that world and be a genuine person?
Well, I mean, I certainly hope so. I think it's actually the easiest way to be if you don't feel like you have to, if there's not some pretense. It's actually easier to go out every day. You're not thinking, all right, now I'm putting on my political face. The other thing is it's actually a more rewarding experience. I mean, you know, these people that I came in contact with that I hugged or spoke to or spoke in their living rooms, those people are still part of my life. And my life is better because they are. I got to call a family in Minnesota. I had been at their house. I talk about it in the book, actually. Been at their house for an event and spent a lot of time with their daughter reading a story to her in the room before the event. He ran for Congress and he won in his district. So here's somebody who I just made contact with. Now I'm going to have a friend who's a congressman they are my friends because I didn't come in as somebody political. I came in and thought these are real people. I like them. You know, they care about the same things I care about, and so the process was more rewarding for me. Each event was more rewarding for me because I came in as myself, left as myself, maybe with a few new friends.
Elizabeth Edwards joins me in the studio. And, you know, there's a lot about the life you've lived that many people would have trouble fully imagining. I mean, being the wife of a presidential candidate. But the one piece that, if people haven't been through it, every parent thinks about is the loss you actually took. It's kind of the central, I mean, it just towers, I'm sure, in your life. It would in anybody's. Remind us of the circumstances that you write about so intimately in Saving Grace, of that loss of your son, Wade.
In 1966, we had, honestly, seemed like the perfect family.
96.
Did mm-hmm. I say 86?
66.
I said 66.
That's Gee-many. Going back.
Boy, that is going back. I was in high school in 66.
But 96,
In 96, I was, we had a perfect family. Wade was 16. Kate had just turned 14. And John was successful in what he did.
Lawyer, very successful at it, become wealthy.
And you know, we had the station wagon and the dog, mm-hmm. and life looked like a picture postcard. And Kate and I actually were flying back from Boston Airport. We'd been in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. Flying back from Logan to Raleigh right before spring break, mm-hmm. and we got home, arranged to head down to the beach. Wade had gone on before us, mm-hmm. with a friend. But we didn't know as we were arriving home is that he had already died. Wind had blown his car from this road. When he tried to get it back on, he'd overcorrected and the car had flipped. The boy next to him walked away and he died instantly.
Could you read for us from that segment of the book where you write about that day?
Yes. I didn't have some second sense that he was in trouble. Kate and I were flying home from New Hampshire. John met us at the airport, and we talked about the high school she'd visited, the choice she now had to make, and the long-awaited week at the beach. Wade had gone on ahead with three classmates, two cars of two boys each, leaving after school with hopes of getting down early to catch the last of the sun on that first day. So the driveway was empty when we pulled in, and empty as we began packing for the week, and empty when I walked through the living room to call upstairs to Kate that we would leave in half an hour. That's when I saw it. The state trooper's car, pulling into the driveway and up our hill. I opened the front door as the driver stepped out of the cruiser. I spoke before he did, pleaded really. It could only be one thing. Tell me he's alive. Is this the home of Lucius Edwards? No one but his friends making fun used Wade's first name. Tell me he's alive. Is this the home of Lucius Edwards? You have to tell me he's alive, my voice breaking. There was no gentle way to say it. He is dead.
Elizabeth Edwards reading from her new memoir, Saving Graces. And I want to look at how you pulled through that, but we have listeners who want to join you as well. Carlos is calling from Boston. Carlos, you're on the air with Elizabeth Edwards.
Thank thank you for having me and your wonderful program. And my heart go to all those families who are going through these mourning moments in life, which is no script from them. It's just the way they happen, and we got to deal with them. My son got killed in Iraq 2 years ago. He was only 19. He started fighting in Iraq, you know, at a very young age, like many of them. I participated yesterday in Veteran for Peace Parade, mm-hmm. for Veteran for Peace. And in front of us was a lot of young ROTC members from high schools everywhere. And you can see how young they are. Mm-hmm. And when we are in this situation, it's hard to mourning without so much pain because for what we see and what we hear every day. But, you know, we got to continue and try to make the best we can. Like myself, this past election day, I decided to go to Virginia. And the way I'm mourning my son, you know, and let him know how I feel to the rest of the American people is by putting a cask at the back of my truck, and very personal, with his name on it.
What is his name, Carlos?
Lance Corporal Alexander Arredondo from Jamaica Plain. And I went to Virginia, and I parked in front of Alexandria, City Hall, and I made my point there to a lot of them, or the citizens from that county, how I was feeling, and I think was the better way for me to express my First Amendment of the Constitution.
Mm. Elizabeth Edwards?
Carlos, I'm very sorry about the death of your son. But I'm also really proud of you because you already know the lesson that I learned, and that is that you wish more than anything you could change it. 55,000 people a year lose children, and we all wish we could change it. Since we can't, we have to find some way to make both their lives and their deaths make sense. The very first vote I cast when I was 21, because that was the voting age then, was in Alexandria, Virginia. So I like that you went there and used that opportunity to speak about how important your son's life was and how much more care we need to take in the decisions that we make so that we don't send our boys unnecessarily into war.
Carlos, thank you very much for calling. We honor your son's sacrifice, and we're sorry for it.
And also we have to remember all the veterans who died in the wars and also the ones with injuries in all the hospitals. Thank you.
That includes my father, Carlos.
God bless him and all these people. Thank you.
Carlos, thank you for calling. Elizabeth Edwards, I wish you'd describe, we got the moment of this terrible news. Give us a sense of the time that followed for those who may be on that path now, how you worked your way back up through that, the time you spent at the gravesite, the sort of detail of how you managed to go through.
Carlos could probably tell you as well that my first feelings were that someone had opened, you know, the drain and every bit of me had emptied out. So my first recollections are not recollections of enormous emotion, but of complete emptiness. As I went on, I tried to grieve in the way that gave me the most comfort. And the way that gave me the most comfort was that I went to Wade's grave daily. If people choose not to do that, and that's not what's right for them, they shouldn't do it just because I did it. They should do what feels good to them. Mm-hmm. But I went daily. Wade was 16. He came home in the afternoons, was part of my everyday. And so, I mean, I worked until he came home, and then I went home as well, sometimes to see him, but also to protect my house from all those boys who would come over to the house all the time.
You took the school reading list he would have had and read it at his gravesite.
I did the things that we had always done.
Out loud, as if to him.
As if to him. And it was very therapeutic for me. First I read the Bible, then I read Sages and Dreamers, and then when I was through with those.
Elie Wiesel's book.
Great book. Mm-hmm. And then I read the 12th grade reading list. That gave me a feeling of connection with him that got me through a period that was extremely difficult. And then, like Carlos, we tried to do something that was important in his name, something that he might have done as well. I think that Carlos believes, and may be right, that his son would have marched in Veterans for Peace had he come home on his own two feet. And we thought that Wade would have tried to reach out to the young people that he knew. And so we started a computer center, and that occupied me for several years until I got my breath again. Mm. I describe it sometimes as if you'd lost it. People often think, because we want our friends who've been through this to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, and so we say, you know, we hope they're now over this. Mm-hmm. And you're never over it. And my example is if we'd lost a leg instead mm-hmm. of a son, mm-hmm. they wouldn't say, "Are you over it yet?"
The leg's gone.
The
it's
leg's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to learn a new way of walking. We had to learn a new way of living, and recognizing the absence of this important part of us. Mm. And that's what we did. But over a period of time, you do learn that new way.
It's your memoir, and you're very intimate in describing your path back from that loss. Your husband, John Edwards, dealing with this loss is much less chronicled here. But can you share that with us? Can you describe it? I mean, yours is so open here. His is not clear. How did he deal with the loss of his eldest son?
Well, he did a couple of things, and he has a book that he published several years ago called Four Trials, and he talks a little about how therapeutic his work was. He wrote a great deal and read a great deal after Wade died. It was a period of time he didn't work. And then he threw himself into this computer lab that we opened across the street from the high school. Mm-hmm. He basically did that 24 hours a day for a long time. I understand Wade died April 4th. By the beginning of October of 1996, we had opened a computer lab where he had gotten people to donate computers. He, you know, found the property, had it renovated. You know, he really worked, threw himself into it. And I think that was very therapeutic for him.
Did he sit with you at the graveside, or did he see that as your, the mother's mourning way?
He did sit with me for a while until he finally told me this was not really right for him. It was very sweet of him to do what wasn't exactly right for him. And he still goes constantly, but I think he wants to go by himself and so, you know, and spend the time himself there. And so now we don't do it the way he graciously and trying to help mm-hmm. me did it with me for so long.
We're talking with Elizabeth Edwards, wife of John Edwards. Anne is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would just like to say how impressed I am that you're writing this book. It's one I've wanted to written for a long time. And you're doing wonderful work with the grieving and getting all this out. I know how hard it is. I, too, lost the son at 3 months. And it is not anything you ever get over. And I moved on, too, with a new child and my life. It's a very difficult, and I'm so impressed, and thank you so much.
And does it help to hear someone else who's been through it speak up publicly?
Yes, very, very much so. I really appreciate this a lot. I do.
Thanks for calling in. I wanted to let me say a couple of things. One is, you know, every loss has its blessings, you know, that come with it. We have a lot of blessings from Wade's life that we carry with us, and his death has also put a lot of pettiness in that we sometimes get obsessed with in perspective. So we no longer worry about any of that anymore. I think that, and also because he was 16 and had, you know, friends who remember him, that in some ways that's easier. I think sometimes the experience you had of losing a child at 3 months is one of the harder losses to live with, because you know that you're the carrier of your son. And one of the things I'd like to tell people, which they may not know because we care about our friends, we don't want to hurt them, some people are hesitant to mention the names of the children who have died because they don't want to remind us that they've died. Mm. In fact, it's nice to have somebody, I think, and maybe Anne agrees.
Say it, speak to it.
And remember that he lived.
Mm-hmm. It's a kind of existence. It's an
acknowledgement mm-hmm. that they had a place on this earth and they made an impression instead of pretending that they never were here at all.
Anne, we're sorry for your loss. We thank you for your call. Elizabeth Edwards, let me ask you, after this loss of Wade, you had an older daughter, but you decided to plunge back in to having kids, and you weren't young anymore.
I wasn't.
You had fertility treatments to do that, and then comes the campaign. You're in Wisconsin. You find a lump in your breast. You've got breast cancer. You ultimately find out in Boston just the same day,
right,
down for a biopsy. Now, you say Dana-Farber, but we got calls this morning at Mass General. But
I definitely had the surgery at Mass General, but as I described, I went in, like you do in a campaign, I went in the back. I did not go in the front door of wherever I went in,
right,
and was led to believe.
I'm sure there was a lot on your mind that morning.
I am willing to be corrected. but Barbara Smith at Mass General was my surgeon, and I couldn't have had more confidence in her.
Do the doctors say, do you fear or suspect, was there any link between the fertility treatment and the eventual breast cancer?
I understand that they're examining the possibility of links between these, but that the kind of cancer I had was not because we think of breast cancer as one disease. It's actually a collection of lots of different diseases that happen, cancers that happen in the breast. That mine is not what they think is there might be any link to the fertility treatments. But honestly, if you told me I had to go through breast cancer to get those two kids, I would have said, okay, it's a deal.
Wow.
They're great.
This gets to the heart, though, of the price that politics can take. I mean, you suspected, maybe this is a cyst, but maybe it's not. You had x-rays, I think, and their reading was not at all, no smiles when they gave you that.
Not encouraging.
But you put off the formal diagnosis until after the election. Was that a kind of sacrifice for your husband's career, not to distract on the home stretch to a very, very close-fought election in 2004?
Well, it makes it sound like I was gambling with my health. But honestly, the mammogram, which took place a week after I found the lump when I returned to my hometown, mammogram and ultrasound were on a Friday, and it was the following Wednesday I had the biopsy. I think that probably most people would have had a similar kind of timeline, even without the election intervening. But I was glad, actually, not to be distracted during that time period any more than we were.
But you don't feel like you were putting your life on the line to keep it under wraps for another 2 weeks while the election went to the conclusion it did.
Well, I mean, I think I did things reasonably timely. About mm-hmm. a week later, from finding the lump to the mammogram, If anybody was traveling, they would have waited till they got home, and have the mammogram done at home, which I did, and then 5 days later, for the biopsy,
and then the whole shebang, the treatment, the hair loss, you name it.
Chemotherapy started a week after the election, so I mean I think I've compacted it pretty closely. Actually, it just happened that there was a fairly important election that happened in the middle of all of that.
Wanda's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Wanda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Ms. Edwards.
Hey, Wanda.
I was listening to your interview today, and it gave me the opportunity to reflect on the loss of my son. My son, Darren, died almost 2 years ago. He was 21 years old, and one of the memories that your interview has brought up for me today is that Darren and I were very much involved in the campaign of Mr. Edwards and Senator Kerry. This was going to be Darren's first opportunity to vote. And, we really got involved in going to pass out literature at the fair and places like that. And we got the opportunity to meet Mr. Edwards here in Columbia. And that was pretty exciting for us and for Darren. I thought he was going to be kind of upset because you know how rallies are. You think that the candidate's going to appear at a certain time, and a lot of times
they don't.
They don't. So just hearing you talk about your loss, and it's something that's still pretty raw with me, but it gave me the opportunity to think about one of the good times that we spent and, something that we did that he really got involved in, that we did together.
Wanda, that gives me so much pleasure my speaking today has given you the opportunity to reflect on happy moments. And sometimes we think, it's hard at first, and 2 years may sound like a lot to some people who haven't been through it. 2 years is very early in this process, there does come a point where, you know, you can celebrate his birthday again, because that was a great day when you were given a great gift of Darren's life. And we celebrate Wade's birthday still. And the fact that you now are able to focus on the happy moments, on the gift that his life was, thank you for your help in South Carolina. Part of the book has in one of the characters in this book is a great friend of mine who traveled with me in the campaign, Hargrave McElroy, who's actually from Columbia, South Carolina, So I have a very warm feeling about the whole state, but about Columbia in particular.
Right down there in South Carolina territory. Wanda, thank you very much for your call. Let's get one from Mason City, Iowa. Ann is on the line. Hi, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to let you know, Elizabeth, you and I have met in Hampton, Iowa, at a tiny restaurant when you were campaigning. But wanted you to know that I took your book and I used part of it in two sermons that I had the opportunity to preach, not a part that would you'd normally be questioned about, I don't think, on this book tour, but the part about where you talked about knowing people's first names, knowing who had waited on you at Target, and other kinds of arenas of your life, the importance that you place on people. And I think it would be great to have you maybe talk a little bit about where you came by that concept of treating all people with dignity and not having any invisible people.
And that's great, and straight from the pulpit, it sounds like you use it there.
Yeah.
Elizabeth,
yeah.
You're in church with Anne. What do you say, Elizabeth?
Well, first, I really appreciate you giving a megaphone to that part of the book, because it really is important, and it's what has allowed me to create this great tapestry that was such enormous support to me, because people, I found support from, you know, the people you might expect, the professionals with whom I worked or the people who lived in my neighborhood, but I found support from the cashier at my grocery store, from the mailman who came to our house, because we had brought them into our lives. I think it was you learn a lot from the way you grow up. My dad was the kind of person who never knew a stranger, spoke to everyone every place we went.
You were a military kid, moved around a lot, spent a lot of time abroad in Japan.
We did. My dad was an officer, but and my mother had grown up in a military family as the daughter of an officer, but we were taught that, you know, military doesn't work without the enlisted people's hard work. And so we were always taught to treat every person with enormous respect. John's father, who worked in a mill, said he can tell in the first minute whether the person with whom he's speaking respects him. And
most of us can, I think.
Yeah, and it makes a difference whether you treat somebody as if they matter. Of course, it also helps that I did waitress, you know, and I had the experience of being the invisible person to really appreciate that it made a difference if you reach out.
And keep on preaching, and thank you for your call. Elizabeth Edwards, there's a call from Iowa. Of course, that's political stomping grounds if there ever were any. We heard from Wanda in South Carolina, had worked on the campaign. Some people already have looked at this book and said, this is part of John Edwards, you know, sort of prepping the ground for another run at the White House. Is it?
It's not, actually. And, of course, if it were, there'd be a lot more of John in the book. although he is, of course, maybe my number one saving grace. He's not a big part of the book. There was a review in the Washington Post where they criticized me for not having discussed his policies, and I thought, boy, you didn't get this book at all, did you?
But you've been out on the campaign trail, and this Common Touch piece actually became an issue the last time on the presidential trail in the Kerry Edwards campaign, and more on the Kerry side of that campaign. You write about how you and John would spend your anniversary dinners at Wendy's because you did early on and you just kept at it. There's a scene in the book where you describe doing that with John Kerry. I wonder if you could set that up and read it for us.
Sure. I'm not really talking out of school. This did hit the news, so I wasn't saying anything that wasn't already out there. John and I had always gone to Wendy's, and the day after we left Boston, the convention was happened to be our anniversary. So on our way way into Pennsylvania, we stopped at a Wendy's for us to have dinner there or lunch there.
Teresa Heinz Carey along also. Everybody's there.
It was two buses full mm-hmm. of full of people associated with the campaign, plus of course the press and Secret Service. I want to say something before I preface this, and that is that John Kerry's policies protected all those people who were in Wendy's, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and that was the most important part for a president, is that his policies protect us.
Or would have, might have.
Yes. In another scenario might have. But this is what I wrote about our visit there. The patrons at Wendy's were not alerted. Not only were cameramen suddenly leaning over them, not only were Secret Service agents filling every available square inch of floor space, but even if they'd been able to get up, there was no way to leave unless they'd walked to the restaurant. The parking lots were all blocked. We all ate. Teresa had chili, John Kerry a hamburger. John and I ordered our usual number one combos. Also celebrating were Kate, the Carey girls, the Hines boys, and Ben Affleck, who was traveling with us for those first days. We ate and got back in our respective buses. At the next stop, we were asked about the gourmet meal we'd eaten. It was great, we said. Wendy's always is. Not Wendy's, the reporter said. The five-star gourmet meal delivered to our bus after the Wendy's stop. How was that meal? We had no idea what he was talking about. It sorted itself out in a day or two. It turned out that the Careys had never eaten at a Wendy's, and although they were willing to go with us, they were good sports, they made sure that they had a backup, but quite a nice backup, willing to deliver to the bus if they hated it.
And so there were John Kerry and Teresa Heinz Carey ready with an alternate meal in case Wendy's just didn't cut it for them.
Yeah, but I have to say, John Kerry ate his hamburger,
and
Teresa's commented that the chili was pretty good. It must have been made with Heinz products.
That's good. But here's my question out of that. If there is a John Edwards run for the White House, not a Kerry Edwards, but an Edwards fill in the blank, how do you expect the tenor of that will be different with him in the if he were in the lead slot from the Kerry Edwards campaign?
I mean, campaigns unfortunately have a history of being of separating the people who are speaking from the people who are listening, and we have tried and. Sometimes you can do it in a small setting, as I did with Anne in Hampton, Iowa. But you try to close that gap in every way that you can, you know. And you all have just been through a blistering political season, where when you have that distance, people feel freer to say ugly things
mm-hmm.
because they, you know, you're not as intimate in your conversation. So we will try to, and we tried to the last time, we'll try again to close that gap so the conversation is more intimate, more civil, more respectful, and also becomes more of a two-way conversation. Love the internet because that happens more there sometimes than in political rally settings.
You were quoted recently as saying that your life choices had made you happier than Senator Hillary Clinton. Now, you came back and said they didn't get that exactly right, and you apologized, and you heard from them. But what were you saying there?
I was fairly aggravated at Ladies' Home Journal because it wasn't actually a transcript. Someone was taking notes at the other end of the table, and someone had asked me to compare myself to Hillary Clinton, and which I probably shouldn't have taken the bait. Mm. And I apologized to Hillary for taking the bait on the question and also for using words that might have been misconstrued, because these were. What I said was that we had made a lot of the same choices. We had both gone to law school, met the man we married mm-hmm. in law school. Mm-hmm. We'd both been lawyers for a while, married to politicians. And we both chosen to have a family while we were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I changed with the decisions I had made. After Wade died, I never went back to the practice of law.
Mm-hmm.
I was already practicing only about 2/3 of a day every day, but I quit altogether.
And you're certainly not running for office yourself.
And I'm not running for office myself.
So are you saying that's not the path to happiness for a woman?
No. I'm not. I mm-hmm. said the choices that I made for mm-hmm. myself mm-hmm. made me happier than the choices that I had made when I was making Hillary's the same choices Hillary had made with the political life. The political life and the professional life, and it is honestly the truth. I mean, I am happier. I am a happier person now
for you,
for me, and it's just like if anybody reads the book, I give people permission to lead their life anyway. I think it's very, very hard to be a as good a lawyer as you want to be, and to be as good a parent as you want to be. There are times when they're going to be in conflict, and that conflict is very hard for women. It tears you apart. Not having that conflict, you know, requires either, you know, making arrangements I didn't make when I was trying to do both at one time, or giving one of them up. And honestly, the practice of law had become sort of ugly. It was and mean spirited, and I wasn't unhappy to have left it. And what I traded it for was, you know, these giggly little kids who, you know, are the joy of my life. Mm. And I'm, you know, I'm not unhappy with the choices that I made. I apparently was either unclear to the woman who was sitting down the table taking notes, or I used words that were capable of being misconstrued.
Does Hillary Clinton look like a happy person to you?
I think she's made the choices she wanted to make. I think that she would, if I got to do it over again, I would make my choices. I think if she got to do it over again, she'd make her choices. Mm. And that's the only test there is, isn't there?
I guess so. Sherry's calling from Cheshire, Connecticut. Hi, Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say a few things. I bought this book Friday, and I have not been able to put it down. And I want to say that in the last election, I was a Republican. I didn't vote for your husband. I have never lost a child, and as far as I know, I don't have breast cancer, but this is the most amazing book I've read in a long time. I think it speaks to a lot of educated women on a lot of issues about the choices in their life, about their children, about supporting their husband's careers as well as their own. It's just an amazingly well-written book. I think a lot of us politically are teetering in the country, and it brings to light a lot of issues for us in, you know, in politics as well. But in terms of choices to what you were just speaking about, I am leaving work to go get my child, to go get an X-ray with an orthopedic surgeon for a broken bone. And I thought, wow, so many things in this book speak to how women manage so much in our lives today, including being involved in so many things like politics. And I think that there isn't a woman, regardless of her faith or her political preferences, that would not find this book to be amazing.
Sherry, it sounds like it hit your button straight on, and we thank you for your call. Elizabeth Edwards, our time is short. You may be soon back on the campaign trail again. You describe your joy in those giggly children you mentioned just a minute ago. Do you really want to go back into that cauldron of presidential politics if John goes for the nomination?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is that I actually enjoyed it. Odd as that may seem, maybe it's growing up in a military family where I was always going into rooms of strangers. For me, that's a great experience. And it's like seeing the country in a better way than going from one tourist resort to the next. You're in people's kitchens. You're at their bowling alley and their cafes, and you're really getting to see America, which is great. And the other thing that happens, you know, John gave a large part of his life when we were married with our first set of children, giving his time to other people. And my children saw that, saw him give up a lot of time that might have gone to them to help other families. And I think they became better adults for that. I'm so proud of our daughter, who's 24, and very proud of the way Wade grew up.
So there's a kind of parenting, even when you may be taken away.
Yeah, oddly, you're teaching them a lesson at the same time you're doing it, and they enjoyed the campaigning as well. So you know, it's not as intensive as the parenting as when you're there at home every single day, but it's parenting nonetheless.
Elizabeth Edwards, we appreciate your candor about that campaign trail, about your own health, about the losses the family's taken, and your road back from those losses. You can hear echoing from people how much they appreciate it as well. Thanks a lot for being with us.
It was great to be with you, Tom.
Elizabeth Edwards, the new book, her memoir, Saving Graces, Finding Solace and Strength from Friends and Strangers. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Philip Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Daniel Ankeles and Vince Fairchild. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.